have is because of the fact that we have Jesus at the center. And apart from us being in fellowship with him, we would very likely have no fellowship with one another. And even more likely, as our society and many other societies demonstrate over and over again, that we would have lots of disunity and lots of struggles and quarrels and fights among us. So thankful that we have Christ to come together over. We're thankful that we have folks like Aaron that can help us see how our faith plays out in every area of life, and in this particular way, in sciences. So pray that you will gift our brother this morning with words, with wisdom, with truth, so that we can be better informed in terms of how to live our lives and share our faith and grow in our knowledge and understanding of you. So pray that you'd be at work this morning on our behalf in that way. To your glory and praise, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Yes, it is truly the prayer that it's to God's glory ultimately. So this has been a great joy for me to teach, of course, because I've enjoyed digging into this in my scientific career since becoming a Christian. It was really the whole concept of science and Christianity had to be compatible in my mind to even get me interested in Christianity. Now, of course, that's backward for most people who come with a faith view of science, but I was coming from a scientific view. So the fact that we seek one truth is where I always try to remind myself. We're seeking one truth, and it's God's truth. So today we're going to look at intelligent design. This is both a movement and a theory, so we will look at both of these just very briefly and go over some, introduce you to some of the major figures, the people who are behind this, the movement, and then talk about the theory a little bit. So it likely is not going to be terribly deep, but hopefully it will give us some context for what we may see in politics and in contemporary news if we hear about what is this intelligent design movement. Should we as Christians be supporting the movement or not? That's a ultimate question that if we may have to decide on at some point. All right, so this is a fun comic. I saw this many, many years ago. It shows two scientists, you know, mathematicians at the board, and the elder saying, "I think you should be more explicit here in step two." And if you read step two, it says, "Then a miracle occurs," right? So the first step is some math, and a miracle occurs, and then the other one. So I've seen this in my classes that I was taught as a scientist. They say, "Well, you know, we know the beginning and we know the end, and it's just a miracle in the middle here." And what they mean by that is that we have not yet found the science to glue those pieces together, right? It's a mystery. But that's part of the fun part of science, that there are a lot of mysteries that we have to go fill in. But scientists would never knowingly appeal to something that is a miracle because they would say it's outside of science. So the intelligent design movement is trying to somehow bridge the gap here between science and what science considers to be miraculous and outside the realm of science, and say, is there some sort of common ground or movement that science can make toward understanding that there may have been an intelligent designer to the universe? So that's in its kind of weakest form. So as I said, intelligent design is both a theory and a movement. So the theory part of intelligent design is really the science part. This is where intelligent design proponents are trying to do science itself and with certain assumptions removed that are on top of standard science. So standard science, often you see definitions of science, which of course there's no philosophers of science cannot agree on what a standard definition of science should be, but generally it holds that you have to seek for some sort of natural explanation for observed phenomena. And if you remember way back when we were talking about the nature of science, this is one of the definitions that the National Academy of Science used. It was the search for natural explanation of observed phenomena. So the question is that a good definition of science? Well, intelligent design as a theory says that is not a definition of science. Because if you restrict yourself only to natural explanations for observed phenomena, you preclude at the beginning any potential external factors such as a supernatural intelligence. But they say you also preclude even natural intelligence as being a conclusion to your science, which if you think about it, that doesn't make any sense. We scientists every day come to the conclusion that certain entities or observed phenomena were created by an intelligence, but they would ascribe that intelligence to man, which makes sense. So we say, you know, as we used the example before, if you're driving through the hills and you see a skyscraper, you would never say, well, that was done by random chance. You would say, no, that came from intelligence. We know there's a designer to that because it has certain structural forms that we know to be designed. And that designer has to be human in that case, is the idea. But intelligent design theory, if it's defined by, there are a few different websites that kind of support intelligent design as a movement. They define intelligent design theory. They're all very similar. It goes something like this. It's the theory of intelligent design holds that certain features of the universe and living things are best explained by an intelligent cause and are not the result of undirected chance-based processes, such as Darwinian evolution. Now, the such as can be removed, and it just says the idea is that in science, when we observe nature, we should admit the possibility of concluding that some structures were better explained by being created by an intelligence than by natural chance. That's all that intelligent design theory is really trying to push. Okay? So if we think of that as the scientific theory part of intelligent design, it's extremely weak as a change to existing science, I would say. Now, the philosophy is really powerful, but scientists shouldn't necessarily be afraid of this, right? It doesn't preclude them coming to natural conclusions for natural phenomena. It doesn't change the way scientists do anything at this point. If you're a committed naturalist, you can say, well, I'm going to look for natural explanations for this all day long. Even an intelligent design scientist would tend to say that is a good course of action. You look for a natural explanation before you would resort to some sort of intelligent design explanation. But the argument is that the types of structures you're looking at are so vastly different that it's obvious which one was created by an intelligence and which wasn't. Now, it's not necessarily obvious because they're trying to push this in science. So the idea is that as a scientific theory then, we really just seek to admit the possibility of intelligent designer making some things in the universe. So I'll give you examples of that way at the end as we go through some of the evidences as to why scientists were kind of pushed this direction. And many, many intelligent design scientists are creationists. They're either Christians or Jews or Muslims, and they believe that there absolutely is a God who founded the universe and created things. So of course it's natural for them to think, I have to admit the possibility that there is a God and that his fingerprints are on science. And if I don't, if you shut off that part of your scientific brain, you say, well, now I'm playing in this natural realm with a limited set of tools, a toolbox that only allows me to come up with natural explanations, and I cannot come to the proper conclusion. So you can see, if you're a scientist and you believe there's a God, it's natural to support intelligent design as a scientific endeavor, because you're drawn to that conclusion anyway, that, you know, hey, it's pointing toward God, right? And scripture is big on this too, that when we observe nature, it shows the handiwork of God, shows his fingerprints. I mean, he has left his imprint on his creation, so we should be able to see that. Well, science isn't blind to those things, and all intelligent design is saying is science should be able to admit this possibility. Okay. Makes sense as a theory? It's essentially, it's very narrow. It has very little political, you know, overtones in the scientific theory, right? Make sense? Good so far? All right. When people say intelligent design, then, they also get mixed up with what is the intelligent design movement. Now, there's a political movement for intelligent design as well. And for good reason. If you believe that something is true, and you're a proponent of this, and you're a scientist, and you're an educator, you're going to try to match those and say, look, I want to be able to tell people what I believe to be is the truth. Right? So I'm going to try to push this. So the intelligent design movement then, in this sense, intelligent design or ID, refers to a scientific research program as well as a community of scientists, philosophers, and other scholars who seek evidence of design in nature. Okay. So there, it's a little backward in this definition from what a scientist would normally do. It's a community that seeks evidence of design in nature. So that's where he's saying, hey, I know there's design. I want to go find it, right? Which is a fine movement, but is really kind of bad science in some ways. Because scientists would say, no, we have to let the evidence speak for itself and draw us to the conclusion of design rather than saying, hey, let me find all the evidence that supports my conclusion that there's a designer. That's one of the largest arguments against that the scientific community will pose against creation science. Say, well, you've just pulled select evidence and jammed it underneath your category of this supports creation. What about the preponderance of other evidence you haven't addressed, right? So it's a valid criticism, but as a movement, it makes sense. You say, look, we're gonna find the evidence that supports our movement. The science also should support it, hopefully, right? You're not doing it apart from the science. So hopefully those two are combined in that sense. Okay, so discovery.org, if you want a whole bunch of information, discovery.org has a lot about the movement, information for educators and schools, what they actually expect or would like you to teach in a school versus definitely don't, and these sorts of things. So it's pretty well done. Yep. Right,
so
right.
How, maybe from your experience, how do you see that criticism play itself out? Mm-hmm. Is there not validity among scientists when it comes to both of those experiences?
Okay, good question. So Brad's bringing up the essentially the presuppositions that scientists have when they approach a topic, right? So the myth of the scientific method is that we don't push our ideas and theories onto the data, right? The data speaks for itself. But as we talked a number of weeks ago, data itself is meaningless. It has to go through a filter of interpretation. It has to go instruments to brain. I mean, instruments even being your eyes, your senses, gets interpreted through electrical signals in your brain and your retina, you know. We never get direct access to the data itself. And so we come with certain models that we place onto the world, and we naturally, as human beings, try to filter those things that fit and don't fit. And sometimes we ignore data by accident because it just doesn't fit our model. That doesn't make any sense. And to be honest, I do this every day in my work. We'll be taking measurements of our photon detectors, and we'll be sweeping laser powers and do these things. And we see a curve that you're like, what is going on here? This thing's all over the place. It's doing weird wiggles. We're like, okay, clearly we're gonna throw this out. Why? Because it absolutely points to an instrumental problem, an error in the instrument. The system is not behaving the way we expect it to. So we go and we check all our cables, we do, you know, figure out the bug in our software, whatever. Oh, we forgot to turn this on. Let's go try again. Woo, there you go. Now we got the curve we're expecting. Well, is that unscientific? Sometimes, right? If you are saying, I'm gonna throw out data because of some presupposition I have on what I'm expecting, you could be throwing out a lot of good information, right? Which is true. But if scientists had to keep, there was a movement I heard about recently, they said scientists should be required to keep all data they ever collect and archive it and present it available to the public. And I thought about what I take as data. It is 98% trash. And I know it's 98% trash because we've had problems. We're trying something new. Things don't work. You know, if you had to record every message your computer ever gave you as useful information, right? You're like, no. I know that this is an error message because Microsoft Word can't find my file, right? I'm not gonna record this. This is useless, right? Scientists do the same thing. This is an error message. This is an error message. This is wrong. Now, have scientists thrown out good data before? Absolutely. And have they ignored for decades amazing phenomena because it didn't match their model? Absolutely, right? So yes, it's a problem. We don't know in science. The criteria on which to accept or reject data is a very loose one. But the scientific community has a paradigm in which it works right now. As long as you are within that paradigm, you have the same set of assumptions toward your data, you'll get published, you'll get promoted, you'll get tenure, you'll be able to have a career, right? If you're outside of that paradigm, like the Ben Stein movie, Expelled, which if you've ever seen this movie of Ben Stein interviewing people about the intelligent design movement, it's quite funny, cheeky, and a little bit disturbing, but because he likens it to the Nazi Holocaust. But it is an interesting movie. It does this. You know, if you're in the tower, the ivory tower of academia, you're not going to get tenure if you're an intelligent design creationist. It's not going to happen because you don't fit, right? And so Ben Stein thought this was a bad thing because he said, look, shouldn't science admit the possibility of a plethora of ideas? But in reality, it protects itself as well. So the long answer to your question, the natural assumptions are those that are accepted by the community. So you have to defend very carefully any sort of presuppositions or assumptions that are different than that. And then you start poking at the foundations of science that make most scientists uncomfortable, because they're happy working within the current framework without actually underlying or analyzing the underlying assumptions that they have about what they're doing. So we do a lot of what we do without really understanding why we're doing it. It's too much to think about. And when I start asking scientific friends about these things, they say, oh, I don't want to learn about God, I'm too lazy. I had one guy tell me that, I'm too lazy. Like, that just means that you just have zero, you've actually defined zero chance that God exists. Literally zero in his head. Because if there's a fraction of a percent of a chance that God was real, any self-respecting scientist would look at that and say, that is probably the most important question that I can answer, so I'm going to go look at that. So that's where your presuppositions just close off, it's blindness, close off an entire set of inquiry. So that answer your question eventually? Okay. Sorry. You can see I can get on a soapbox about that one. Okay, but then we can rewind and go back to our first discussions on science and the nature of science itself, because scientists don't even really understand science very well. Okay, so as a movement then, the movement seeks to provide scientific questions, so real scientific questions, to Darwinism, or kind of in opposition to Darwinism or Darwinian natural selection or naturalism itself. And it pushes farther than Darwinism, but that's the real big focus, because it also goes into inflationary cosmology and Big Bang cosmology and the origin of the universe itself. And I'll have a little slide on that later. Okay. So do we see how there's a movement and there's the science? Clearly the movement is going to take the science and take the theory. But if we want to talk about is intelligent design science, we have to look only at the theory part and define it carefully, so that we don't mix it in with this political movement, which is still a good thing probably to happen, because you want to promote these alternative views if you believe they're correct. But when you look at rebuttals against intelligent design, scientists will often attack the movement instead of the theory. And so you just have to look to see if those attacks are properly aimed, I would say. Okay, are there any questions on kind of the distinction between the theory and the movement? That's just very brief, but I just want to be clear that there are two separate parts of intelligent design there. All right, let's look at kind of these three main people who are kind of focal points of the intelligent design movement. They are scientists, and so they've come up with scientific theories, which I think are interesting, but then they become kind of lightning rods for the intelligent design movement itself. But they published some pretty neat books and have been instructional to me personally in reading these. So the first one is William Dembski. He's a mathematician, a philosopher, and he also graduated from Princeton Theological Seminary, I believe, so he's a theologian. Because he's very mathematical, he has this book that he authored called The Design Inference, Elimination of Chance Through Small Probabilities. So the main thesis of this book is that we can say mathematically that when probabilities get small enough, we should actually set them to zero. Okay? And it's a very small thesis. He says, look, when probabilities get small enough, that is what we define to be impossible. Now, he tries to go through some criteria as to what the limit should be. At what point does something become so improbable that mathematicians should themselves call it zero chance? And so he has this criterion mathematically, and there are pages of mathematics, so I just skipped through a lot of it. But he has this design tree that he came up with, which I have in your notes, this little tiny thing on the side, which is very cryptic. It's the same one up there. It's called his explanatory filter. It's how we process explanations or phenomena when we get it to try to find an explanation. And it's very simple if you go through it, and it makes a lot of sense when you think about it. So the event, so E, is it a high probability event? Here's the decision tree. Is it high probability? Question mark, HP. Is it high? Mathematicians love their letters and don't like writing things out. So high probability, is it a high probability event? That means every time I see this phenomena, given the same initial conditions, is it going to do the same thing over and over again? Okay? If the answer is yes, then we ascribe that phenomenon to regularity or law, right? This is what we call the laws of physics, essentially. Hey, you know, we put a pendulum and it's swinging and we have the same length and the same mass and, you know, it swings back and forth. We say, well, you have an explanatory mechanism for this, that there is a law that is going to make this object do the same thing over and over and over again. An example of, hey, you know, if I paint it red and I paint it green, I don't see a change. You say, okay, now I can filter out which parts of that law are relevant and which parts are not. And so this is the idea, that anything we can try, and you're supposed to do this in this order too, top to bottom. If we can find a law for it, we stop there. We're like, great, we have a law of physics, woohoo! We check it off and we move on because we found something that 100% of the time we can determine the output. All right, if it's not the case, if for some reason we can't find a law of physics or a law of nature that defines the outcome of this event, we go to this kind of intermediate probability. Is it a high probability, low probability? Maybe it's just improbable, but not impossible. So then you say, we're going to try to ascribe this to chance, because in the laws of what we look at, there's so much complexity that we can then see that if we randomly flip a coin, wow, I can get heads and I can get tails, and they come up 50% of the time, and they do this. There's not a law, per se, doing that. There is if you look deeply. But you say, no, we ascribe that combination to chance at that point. That's fine. We ascribe it to chance, and we say that is a perfectly fine thing to do because we can now describe mathematically what's happening with this phenomenon without it being a mystery to us. We can see this going on. All right. If you can't ascribe it to chance because it's not a somewhat probable event, we can't actually quantify how probable it is, he says, then we start to get into this trouble that was undefined under standard mathematics and laws of inference here. So he now defines this thing SP and SP, right? Capitalized and small probability for lowercase SP and specified complexity for this kind of high SP. So specified small probability. Okay. This is where he spends most of his time in the book talking about what does he mean by specified complexity. All he means is if you have a low probability event and yet it hits a target of some sort where you can say ahead of time, usually ahead of time, here is the target of what we're looking at. Now we hit it, we could say, wow, there's something really weird about this. This could not have happened by chance because the probabilities are so low as to be zero by chance. There's not a law to say that this had to happen. So now we have to infer that we have some sort of design in there. There's an intentional mind that has made this happen for some reason that you cannot ascribe to chance and you cannot ascribe to regularity. So that's this whole book, right? Now, he gives a really good example. I really enjoyed it. He said, all right, for instance, you can have low probability events that happen all the time that are not designed. So for instance, imagine you have an archer who's going to shoot bows and arrows from 50 meters away, 150 feet or so, and every time he shoots an arrow, he just randomly shoots an arrow, he runs to the wall and paints a target around it, so he gets a bullseye every time. Right? Well, it's low probability that he's going to hit that point, right? But 100% of the time, he hits the target, right? So you just shoot another one, you go paint around that one. Ah, perfect archer, right? No, we would say there's something wrong with that. That is not a master archer. But if ahead of time, he goes and paints a target, and then he hits every one of those arrows at the bullseye every time, that's a specified target that's limited and is extremely low probability of hitting by chance. Now you just say, that's a master, right? So this is his argument. They say, look, in biology and biological systems, we see a very specific code that does very specific things that we cannot ascribe to chance. We can't ascribe to law. It's not built into the laws of physics that life should exist. So it has to be that we conclude that there was a mind, an intelligent designer behind this. And it goes through the arguments of the mathematics as to what probabilities are really, really low enough to call impossible. And he says, look, if you get something below like 10 to the 120, that's zero. 10 to the 120. A 1 with 120 zeros after it. 1 in 120, no, 10 to the 120. He said, just call this zero. That's, you know, there are only 10 to the 80 particles in the universe. All right, only 10 to the 80 particles in the universe. He said, look, here, 10 to the 40 times more universes to pick a particle from. And you say, oh, I'm going to pick one particle at random, and it happens to be the one you're thinking of. All right, so that's the specified complexity. You say, I'm going to grab one particle in the universe, and you grab one particle of the universe, what's the chance we actually pick the same one? 1 in 10 to the 80. He says, well, okay, I'll give you 40 more orders of magnitude to play with. That's the complexity that we see in biological systems. The probability that those have come about by chance is much, much less than picking a random atom in the universe, your neighbor picking a random atom, and picking the same one. So he says, look, we have to call this zero chance. There's not enough time, matter, or size to the universe to have this happen. It's a very interesting argument, very good book. He also edited a book called Uncommon Descent, which is a super clever title. I love it. So Common Descent is, right, Darwin's, right, model. Uncommon Dissent, meaning disagreement, is a collection of essays from scientists refuting or poking holes in Darwinian evolution as a means of creation. Very, very cool book because it has lots of different authors. So he just edited it, but a very, very good book. Enjoyed both of those. Okay. He also talks about the law of conservation of information, which we also have talked about previously, so he expounds on that a little bit. And so the specified versus unspecified complexity. He makes that distinction very carefully. Okay. Michael Behe, I don't know if any of you have read his book called Darwin's Black Box, The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution. A reasonably good book. He's a biochemist, so it's fairly technical in what he has inside of it, but it's written for a general audience, so you guys should definitely be able to make your way through it. His idea is the sense that biological systems not only are complex, but they're so complex that they have so many interworking pieces that they could not have evolved separately because none of the pieces themselves function independently. And so they have to have evolved, if they did at all, as one working unit. And his example is a mousetrap, a simple, you know, there's a little wooden mousetrap with a spring. So he goes through this example, say, what happens if you mutate a mousetrap? You know, any one of those pieces is missing. It doesn't function as a mousetrap anymore. And then you look at the biological cell and see how infinitely more complex it is than this mousetrap. And so his idea, his concept was, you have an irreducible complexity. You have a complexity to an object that you cannot simplify any further. There's a smallest functioning unit, and that unit must have evolved as one unit, which is impossible according to the probabilities and the time that is allowed. So he posits there has to have been a designer, and he's Catholic, so he says, look, God did this, and this is what I believe in his biochemistry. That was what his science drove him to understand about the nature of that creation, which is interesting. So he uses some specific examples in his book, the bacterial flagellum, that's the picture up there. It literally looks like a motor. I mean, it's got a rotor and a stator and a shaft and a drive and a propeller, and it's got all these fuel mechanisms to pump energy. And this is this little spinning tail on bacteria to make them go la 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 through the water, right? So they've got this little spinning tail. It's a motor. He says, just look at that thing, and let's deconstruct it and say, how would this evolve in pieces if it doesn't have every one of these working parts? It's like trying to take 10% of the engine out of your car and saying, it'll still function pretty well, right? It doesn't work that way. The whole thing works together. And when you specify that flagellum as a motor and you put it next to the way an electric motor works, you say, wow, you know, we can actually name parts of the flagellum, and they do, after the engineer designed motor. A rotor and a stator and your shaft and your bearings and your coils and your, like, this is crazy. We're using engineering language to describe biological phenomena, and then we're claiming there was no engineer. That's what his idea is, right? He says, look, this doesn't make any sense. Okay, the immune system is another one. The immune system is super complex, and you botch one part of it, and we get bad diseases, right? So, and it all works together. You know, it's a crazy system if you think about it. It's fighting everything from the outside and things that get inside. without killing the stuff inside that has to stay. It's really complex, right? So it's a finely tuned system. He says, look, evolutionarily, it has so many failure points that if that wasn't designed together, it would not exist. And then blood clotting is another one. The blood clotting mechanism is extremely complicated too. And any one little part goes wrong, you've got people who bleed to death or people who clot internally, and you know that's not super good for us either. So, all right. So he's drawn a lot of attention because he published this book as a biochemist, and so the scientists have to address the issue. So you'll find a lot of websites where people will say, hey, here's his mousetrap, and here's how it could have evolved in step-by-step processes. And, you know, okay, so you can take that as an argument, but, you know, mousetrap has like five parts. So it was a simple example, and it was already hard to come up with a way that it happened. So there's some interesting discussion on that. All right, and then Stephen Meyer really studies biological information, but he's the least scientific of these. The other two have PhDs in some sort of scientific field. Stephen Meyer is actually has a PhD in philosophy of science, which is reasonable to think about these things, but he's published some papers then at the Discovery Institute, which is where I think he's the president or so of the Discovery Institute now. But he published a book called The Signature in the Cell, DNA and Evidence for Intelligent Design. So he's now looking more at information theory, which we've talked about previously. How does this computer code model of the cell and of DNA point to a designer? So we've talked more in detail about that previously. But he is a Christian. But he's more visible in advocating for ID, intelligent design in schools, and he's testified in hearings and these sorts of things. He's very clear that he is a Christian and believes this for Christian reasons, but that intelligent design should not be thought of as a religious movement. And so that's where it's hard, because a lot of proponents will say, well, everyone who believes intelligent design is religious. Well, if you're a scientist, that's what it drives you to, right? I mean, that's your conclusion. That may not necessarily be your presupposition. Now, for some people, it's the other way around. But if you're driven by the science to say there is an intelligence that created this, it's very natural to try to seek that intelligence out, right? That becomes the next step. So I think that's a red herring, a straw man argument to say, well, we can't listen to these people who are scientists because they're Christians. You're like, well, they're Christians because of where it's led them, right? Or, you know, so it's a bad argument. Okay, so if we just kind of summarize intelligent design, actually not as summarized, this is intelligent design as a science. If we treat intelligent design theory as a science, what does it explicitly claim and not claim? So if we look at the non-claiming, it explicitly makes no claim on the nature of the intelligence, and this is interesting. You say, look, intelligent design, as far as intelligent design cares, as a movement and as a theory, that intelligence could be extraterrestrials, could be aliens that came in and designed our planet, right? Who cares? At that point, they're saying, look, the science itself is just saying we cannot ascribe this to natural processes, and that's the point. So let them say it's an extraterrestrial. You'll get people coming in from the panspermia model of the universe, which is one of the, is that that there was a master race of aliens that has seeded solar systems all around the universe. This is a serious scientific theory. I'm serious. It's called panspermia. It's the idea that this master race, because of what we see in our planet, it's too nice and neat that it had to have come from an intelligence. Now, they may be unwilling to ascribe that to God, but they ascribe it to some master evolved race, right? It's amazing. It's science fiction, but it's real claims that people make in scientific talks. There's no statement or opinion on the age of the universe or age of the Earth. As far as intelligent design is concerned, it could be compatible with mechanism of evolution in long age, short age, doesn't matter. Okay, the idea is they're only making a claim about what is the source of this information and the creation of this information and the entities in the Earth. No statement on the compatibility of science and religion. They're very clear that that's a theology question. That's not a question for intelligent design. They're just pointing the finger at an intelligence. And it's explicitly different than creationism. And so a lot of opponents to intelligent design will say, oh, it's just subversion by the creationist community to get creationism into the schools or something, right? That's definitely not what the movement is about. That's not their goal. Even if they are creationists, the goal is to be very explicitly different than creation science or creationism, to just propose the science, be good science and good teaching. And I hold the leaders there at their word. I try not to ascribe any sort of bad motives to the leaders of the intelligent design movement. And if you do that, you see, they're explicitly clear. Yes, we are Christians, or we're Jews, or we're Muslim, but we care deeply that real science be taught in the schools. So the idea is to try to get at least an alternative opinion available. And one thing I really like is that intelligent design is very clear that they explicitly attempt to work within the bounds of science. So they're not going to use, you know, magic to say, oh, yeah, look, here, this is how it worked. They're using the methods of science to draw conclusions that point outside of current science, which is exactly what science does itself. When you take new data and you say, whoops, I found this weird little blip in my Large Hadron Collider, you say, well, it has to be it's not compatible with any of our current models. Let's go back to the drawing board. What other models do we have here? The only big change is that it would have to maybe abandon naturalism, pure naturalism, which is really hard as a philosophical abandonment for scientists. And it's not a subversion. I don't believe it's pseudoscience, because if it's claimed to be pseudoscience, they would say, well, all right, then tell us how, and we'll modify our mechanisms such that you can agree it's science. Right? And that's fine. That's a fine way to do it. If you say, you're not using scientific methods in doing this, okay. Show us better how to do it, because the evidence itself is pointing to something else, and if you can do it with your methods, you'll come to the same conclusion. So I think that's valid. There have been criticisms on intelligent design that it does not provide any new predictions in science. You say it's all retrodictions. So you find some sort of evidence, and you grab that evidence and say, wow, this points to a designer. But there are some predictions of intelligent design that I think some came after we already knew this, but some not, that we should see complex biological machines. We should see fine-tuned physical constants in the laws of physics. We should see the universe that apparently looks improbable, but designed for us. We should see rapid, fully formed appearance of organisms in the fossil record. That was anti-evolution at that point. They say, look, we should see fully formed organisms. It should not necessarily have this weird gradualism. We should also expect to see the reuse of functional mechanisms and systems in biology reused in other places. Engineers do this all the time, right? Your Ford Focus is going to have very similar things inside to your, you know, F-150. Now, it won't be identical, but if the same engineer works on two parts, they're going to say, hey, you know what? I used a piston over here. I'm going to use a piston here. I mean, I used four wheels over here. I'm going to use four wheels over here. It's natural to reuse working mechanisms, right? Does not necessarily mean they come from a common descendant or ancestor. All right, and a big one, the genetic code that we see inside of cells should be mostly or entirely useful. It should not be junk if there's a designer. It seems like the right thing that you would predict. And they're finding more and more that that's the case, that the junk DNA they thought, as we talked previously, is not actually junk. So these are some interesting things, right? Whether these bear, you know, good scientific conclusions or not, we'll see. But at least you can say the scientific intelligent design scientists are attempting to make scientific predictions. They're working within science, a good faith effort to try to come up with testable and predictable or measurable outcomes in science. So that's admirable. Of course, it's a small minority of scientists who adhere to this. So the amount of progress in that direction is going to be very, very slow unless more people kind of come to these conclusions. All right. From my own background in physics, there was a strange talk I heard when I was in graduate school. He's a very well-known cosmologist. So cosmologist is one who studies the early universe and the inflation of the universe. Different than cosmetologist. So I thought of this, the cosmology, here's how you separate them. Cosmologists study the Big Bang. Cosmetologists study the Big Bangs of the 1980s. There are evidences that they called the anthropic principle. In this talk, he kept saying, oh, we use the anthropic principle for explaining this. I'm like, what is that? So I asked people after the talk. I didn't know. I'd never seen a talk on cosmology before. They said, oh, no, the anthropic principle is where you can explain that we're in a fine-tuned universe by the fact that we're in a fine-tuned universe to exist. We have to exist. If we're to exist at all, it must be in a universe that is tuned for human life, because no other universe would exist where we are in it, right? I'm like, is that a weird, that's called the anthropic principle, which is a man-centered, right? Well, anthropic meaning man. But if you look at these other coincidences in cosmology, you come up to understanding why they have to have some sort of conclusion that the universe was not randomly made. It have to be some locking mechanism for why we find ourselves in this universe. Basically, the laws of physics are so finely tuned that you cannot adjust things like the mass of the proton or the charge on the electron and proton by minuscule degrees, or the entire universe does not exist. The laws of physics, you know, preclude chemistry from ever existing, or binding of atoms ever would just be a sea of light. There'd be nothing out there to exist in terms of matter. So here's some quotes. If you change a little bit the laws of nature, or you change a little bit the constants of nature, like the charge on the electron, then the way the universe develops is so changed that it's very unlikely intelligent life would not, it is very likely that intelligent life would not have been able to develop. David Deutsch, mathematician and physicist at Oxford, if we nudge one of these constants just a few percent in either direction, one of the constants, meaning hundreds of physical constants, no carbon, no life, not even any chemistry, no complexity at all. Paul Davies, another physicist, the really amazing thing is not that life on Earth is balanced on a knife edge, but that the entire universe is balanced on a knife edge. You see, even if you dismiss man as a chance happening, the fact remains that the universe seems unreasonably suited to the existence of life, almost contrived, you might say, a put-up job. And then how precise is the tuning? Here's Michael Turner, astrophysicist. The precision is as if you could throw a dart across the entire universe, hit a bullseye, 1 millimeter in diameter on the other side. So gives you an idea. Say, look, that's how finely every constant is tuned in physics such that this universe exists at all. So the way that physicists get around this is they say, well, there have to have been an infinite number of universes all with different laws of physics, and then only the ones that support life are the ones we can observe, right? The one we're in. So that's this anthropic principle. It's very finely tuned, so much so that it begs you to go to the conclusion that there's some reason that it's so finely tuned. Okay, another evidence, and this was a calculation that I did early in becoming a Christian. I was trying to figure out, okay, let's say you had a primordial soup and it was generating life. And you say, what's the chance that a protein would develop just by random chance? This is something that we should be able to calculate because we know how big proteins are and we know what they're made of. And so I did this calculation. So I got this 1 in 10 to the 65 chance of randomly assembling a single protein from this Robert Sauer at MIT. I assumed, okay, let's say that's the chance. It's really low chance, but you got a lot of tries. If, say, you had a primordial soup on the planet the size of, say, Lake Superior, which is a big primordial soup, right? It would have to be just right with amino acids and everything already. And I said, let's assume that you attempted to form a protein every millisecond. So each time, you know, 1,000 times a second, it's like reconfiguring these proteins, trying to figure out how to do it just randomly. What would be the chance? How long would it take, I calculated, that one protein would randomly form in a primordial soup the size of Lake Superior? I calculated about 28 billion years for one protein, okay? And then you realize, how long would it last? There's no life-sustaining mechanism for that protein. How would it replicate? This is supposed to be self-replicating proteins. Somehow it has no DNA or RNA. There's no mechanism to duplicate it. On what would it function? If it's sitting there, how would nature select for it? What would it be doing that would say, oh, we want to keep this thing, right? Rather than it just randomly falling apart again. And then we note that a typical cell synthesizes approximately 15,000 of these things, right? You say, this is incredibly improbable that life would have ever come up naturally or randomly on the planet. So even this little thing where you say, what's the chance here? Because you don't know where the first cell comes from. Remember, natural selection only works on replicating organisms. So the Achilles heel is, where does that first cell come from? You say it has to come about somewhat randomly in a self-replicating event. So of course it leads us to Psalm 139, right? That we are woven together, right? He wove us together. You think of this phrase, it's exactly how proteins are done. They're woven, they're tangled, and they're put together into this functioning object, which then replicates. It's incredible. And what's interesting is thinking about this weaving in the mother's womb, that's the self-replicating, right? It's just a really cool picture. Okay, and then math itself. This is a really interesting quote by Eugene Wigner, who's a very famous physicist from the early 1900s, pioneer in quantum mechanics. He, as a mathematician and physicist, he noted, of course, that there's this philosophical problem we have, and we talked about it a long time ago, that mathematics and logic irrationally match with the laws of physics so beautifully that we're like, this is an amazing thing. How does mathematics, which you can write down, it has these simple laws, how can it be the language for describing everything we see in the laws of physics? It's so beautifully tied together. It says, the miracle of the appropriateness of the language of mathematics to the formulation of the laws of physics is a wonderful gift, which we neither understand nor deserve. This is a non-Christian, non-religious scientist just saying, this is an incredible mystery. And he felt essentially blessed by it, right? I don't deserve this, but what an amazing gift. We can now describe things mathematically and predict what's going to happen in these laws of physics. What? How does this work? So the philosophy of mathematics and physics cannot answer this question either. Why in the world can we even have a language to describe the universe itself? So these point us to, these evidences point us toward there being some sort of master designer in every part of our world. The design of the laws that run us, the design of the biology that we're made of, everything seems to be designed specifically for the sustaining the human being for a big purpose, right? Now, to go beyond just the statement that yes, we were designed by an intelligence, then requires something deeper, requires then theology, requires some inquiry inside of you to say, I want to know the nature of this intelligence. Who is this that made me, right? And that then is hopefully a starting point to drive people toward seeking the true nature of God. Okay, so last slide. Does intelligent design eliminate the scientific inquiry as an intellectual dead end? Dr. Richard Buggs, geneticist in England, says no. If true, intelligent design is a profound insight into the natural world and a motivator to scientific inquiry. The pioneers of modern science, who were convinced that nature is designed, so people like Newton and Kepler, consequently held that it could be understood by human intellects. This confidence helped to drive the scientific revolution. The reason that we have science at all is because the early founders of modern science believed that the universe was created by an intelligence who wanted us to understand his creation and him. So we can continue to do that. So that's where I think intelligent design should be considered a science. And the movement should be hopefully somewhat successful in bringing that science closer to us too. So that's it. Very quick introduction. But if you have any more questions on this, you can go to these websites. Discovery.org, ideacenter.org is another one. But they all link to each other. So if you go to discovery.org, you'll find some very good literature there on this. As always, if you have more questions on these topics as you do things yourself, send me emails. I love talking about it. And we'll do this again sometime. All right, thank you.